Hello, today is May 26, 2021. Welcome to Meet the Grantmakers Online, a panel sponsored by the Grantsmanship Center, Grants Station, and Fondant Technologies. We hope you enjoy this audio recording.
Welcome everybody, come on in. Come on into the webinar. Thank you for joining us this afternoon or morning, depending on your time zone. My name is Angela Richardson. Welcome everybody. Thank you for joining us. My name is Angela Richardson. I'm a senior trainer here at the Grantsmanship Center, and I'll be your host for today's Meet the Grant Makers webinar. Joining me, I have a beautifully illustrious panel that I think you will find very interesting. We do these webinars quarterly, and each time we're really joined by grant makers from all over the country that are so different in terms of their priorities and where they work. And so I'm really happy to introduce them, and I will do so in just a moment. So just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. The first thing is the all-important question, will this webinar be recorded? Yes, it will be. And if you registered for this webinar, you will receive that recording in an email with a lot of really great follow-up resources coming your way. This particular webinar is sponsored by the Grantsmanship Center, of course, Fondant and Grant Station. So I just want to take the opportunity to thank them for making this available to for all of us to come together and really explore the landscape of grant making, especially in this time, which feels really important. The next housekeeping detail is about closed captioning. So if you need that service, if you look at the bottom of the screen, you can click on live transcript and you should be able to toggle the captioning on and off. So feel free to do that if you need that. Let's see. The way that this webinar will work, we will first introduce our panelists, and then they'll have an opportunity to tell you a little bit about their foundations. Each one of their foundations is so unique. And so they will share a little bit about them, share a little bit about their priorities, and then we will go into the Q&A. Many of you that when you registered, you submitted some questions, more than we're going to be able to get to today, but I did kind of combine a couple and come up with a few that we'll go through today as well. There is a Q&A that you can submit questions. We have a chat mod. We have a question and answer moderator there who will be sending me some of the messages that are coming in live. And so we'll get to as many as we possibly can. And I will apologize in advance that we won't be able to get to all of them, but we will do our best to get to as many as we possibly can that really speak to some of the questions that are coming in that would be beneficial to the whole group. One last thing is that there are links to the foundation, so you'll be able to see their profiles. So as they're talking about their foundations and they're in your area and you didn't know about them, you might want to look them up, and you can do so through that link. So with no further ado, I would like to just share who is joining me on today's webinar. So first I have, and if you could just go like that. First, I have Jackie Statham Allen. She is here from the Bush Foundation. She's been there since 2008, where she is the Education Portfolio Director. She manages the strategy, programs, and partnerships for the Foundation Education Initiative. And Jackie's been in education, working in positions for the St. Paul School District and the Chicago Public School District. So those of you that are in education, you are well accompanied by Jackie, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. Next, we have Tori Irgang from the Chautauqua Region Community Foundation. And Tori's the executive director at this particular foundation. She's been there since 2017, and she maintains a $122 million endowment portfolio that makes more than $3.2 million in local grants each year. So those of you in the New York area, this is your community foundation. But for anyone who's ever worked with a community foundation, this is, or you haven't, this will be great for you all to hear. And then last but certainly not least, we have Paul Moore from the David Bonnet Foundation. Paul is here in Los Angeles, where I am as well, and he's worked for the foundation for more than a decade. As director of programs, he oversees every aspect of the foundation's grant-making process, which includes, in case you don't know, monitoring grant requests, grantee reports, site visits, making funding recommendations, and representing the foundation in events, and soon they'll be live again because we used to do that. So for things like this and others. So I just want to thank you all for being here and in advance for all of the wonderful information that you're going to share with us. So this is who our panel is, and feel free to start putting your questions in there as they go through their different foundations. We'll first start with each panelist having the opportunity to just share, as I've said already, they're different and they're located in different places. But one of my mentors used to say, when you know one foundation, you know exactly that, just one foundation. And I think this panel is really going to demonstrate that. So we have a nice diversity around the types of things that they're interested in. So I wanted each panelist to share a little bit about their foundation, things that they make them unique, and any special initiatives or anything that they wanted to share. So Jackie, we're going to go ahead and start with you.
Wonderful. Well, good afternoon, morning, evening to everyone today. Thank you, Angela, for such a warm welcome to us. And I look forward to learning more about your foundations, Paul and Tori. My name is Jackie Statham Allen, and I am a grant making director at the Bush Foundation. And at the Bush Foundation, we invest in great ideas and the people who power them. And I should explain the Bush Foundation. So we are not the beer, we're not the beans, we're not the bureaucrats as in the presidents. We were founded in 1953 by a 3M executive named Archibald Bush and his wife, Edith. So we've been in existence for quite a while now. And we are a private foundation, regional foundation, that serves Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that geography. And we work on a variety of issues. We have several core grant programs, but I'd like to tell you about one of them, which is our Community Innovation Grant Program. And that is one where we are working to learn about and support great ideas or people that lead to transformational solution and problem solving within the region, within the communities. And by the communities, we mean a lot of different things. Community can be defined by the applicant. It's issue agnostic, but really what we're looking for are ideas that will lead to transformative improvement for the community that the applicant works is looking to serve. It is a grant program that is open for about $20,000 up to a couple million dollars, and it is always open, and we review applications on a rolling basis. I should say that we grant about $50 million per year, and I look forward to sharing more about the foundation as we go on here. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Jackie. Tori, would you go next, please?
Sure. Jackie, I am super excited to listen to what you're going to talk about, granting $50 million a year, and that's tremendous. So, and Paul, I can't wait to learn more about what you're doing every day too. So I come to you from the far southwestern corner of New York State. So if what you know about New York has to do with New York City, you have to go as far from that as you almost can and still be in the state of New York. And that's where we're located. We're the home of the Chautauqua Institution, and our county is named for a lake that is in the middle of it, so Chautauqua Lake. But it's really a pleasure to be here. My community is about 130,000 people in our county, so we're a pretty modest sized community. I'm proud that we have a community foundation that's celebrating 43 years in existence, and really was a community-driven activity. We were not converted from a private foundation, as some community foundations have been over time. We certainly benefited from some seed money from private foundations in our community, but we were the effort of some visionary leaders in our community in the late 1970s, and just so much generosity that has allowed us to accumulate over $120 million in assets and allows us to make over $3.2 to $3.5 million of grants and scholarships. So what will be a little different, I won't talk a lot about scholarships because this is put on by the Grantsmanship Center, but about half of the impact that we have in our community goes out to young people pursuing higher education and job training and certification through scholarships. On the grant making side, we administer designated funds that are automatically paid out to not-for-profits for programs that they administer. Those were set up by donors, and we steward that gift in perpetuity. We also manage agency endowment funds. So nonprofits that choose not to manage their own investment portfolio can choose to do that in a very cost-effective and efficient way through a community foundation. I'm going to do a little sales pitch for the community foundations in your community. But and then, of course, our competitive grants process, which is what I'll talk about obviously mostly today. We have three different processes that run periodically throughout the year. So we run about 12 grant cycles per year. And we have a very, you know, a small grants process that's every other month. And those are for emerging and modest needs that pop up for nonprofits or for emerging and smaller nonprofits to kind of get themselves acclimated to grant writing. And we, going up from there, we have a community service grant process that runs twice a year, and that's for up to $20,000. Grants in size. Those would be grants that may relate more to program, or they could be for modest capital. And then our largest grants are made through what we call our strategic projects process. And those grants have no limit. And they are designed for wide reaching, widespread economic and community benefit. And so it's a little bit vague what fits that criteria. And I would like to say we did that intentionally so that it's available to anyone or any organization or any project that needs it. I think I'll pause there and turn it over to Angela.
Thank you. And then I'll turn it to Paul.
Hey, everyone. Nice to see everyone and nice to meet everyone on the panel. So I'm Paul Moore over at the David Bonnett Foundation. We are a private family foundation here based in Los Angeles. And so let me just talk about David Bonnett. So David Bonnett, he's a technology entrepreneur. He founded a GeoCities back in the late 1990s, took it public, and then sold it to Yahoo for $3.5 billion. So at the end of the day, he is a technology entrepreneur. And so with those proceeds from his tech company, he put money aside for the foundation and also his venture capital. And so the reason why I talk about that is because, you know, he's as a private family foundation, he's still living. He's a fairly young guy in his early 60s. And he is still very much involved with the foundation, and we're kind of like his ethos, right? And so like Angela mentioned before, all foundations, I mean, every foundation is different, right? And so we are really an extension of David's kind of brand, I would say. So the types of funding that we do, we are a very progressive foundation. So we our motto is improving society through social activism. And so our grant making areas, we are one of the largest funders of LGBT issues in the US. We are also one of the largest funders of gun violence prevention, also known as gun control in the US. And then we do some animal language research with gorillas and great apes. So I like to say we do gays and guns. Just kidding. Gays and no guns. So that's what we do. And then we also have the Fund for LA, which is, we fund various arts organizations and whatnot within the LA area. And then our geographic reach, we fund organizations that either have a Southern California or national focus. So it's kind of our grant making. And what also makes us unique is we do not accept unsolicited grant applications. And I know this is folks, I'm sure we'll get into this later, but like, you know, foundations tend to be a black box, right? And so how much darker can it get and like mysterious without accepting unsolicited grant applications? So I'm happy to talk about that. But we moved to that process because the foundation has been around for over 20 years now. I've been here actually for 2 decades now. So what we found was, over the course of 20 years, our strategies have stayed exactly the same. And so we tend to now know who the players are, who the major players are, who are the upcoming folks. And so to save everybody's time, we're like, you don't want to waste our time. So this is why we just moved to this process. But I can talk about this a little bit later. But great to meet everyone. And thank you, everyone, for doing everything that they do. So I'm happy to be here.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you. Just in your introductions, there's so many places that we could go. So I love how each of you is saying, really promoting the type of foundation that you are. So I love that so much. All right, let's jump into it. So as I mentioned to everybody, we had a number of questions come in advance, and I know the questions are starting to come through the live Q&A too. So the first one I really want to start with is really more of a current issue, and I think something that's probably on all of our minds as we're, depending on where you are in the country and depending on, your personal choices, we're emerging in a certain way. Things are opening, certainly here in Los Angeles. We're opening in and people are looking at going back to work, and it's changed the grant making quite a bit in the last year. And so the question I want to pose to our panel, and Jackie, I'm going to start with you, is the question was, as we move out of the COVID-19 response to recovery, what priorities have emerged for your foundation and what are the current priorities? So how are you guys thinking about the landscape now?
Yeah, well, I think that the experience of the pandemic, and with us being located in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities, most of our staff is located here and others are across the region. We think about the pandemic in two ways, of both the disease that was respiratory, but then also the disease, which is racism. And so when we first found ourselves in the situation of the pandemic, we wanted to be very responsive and make sure that we were being able to respond to urgent needs of our community and do it in a way that was sustainable. And so we set aside $50 million of our community reserves in order to invest quickly into the most urgent needs of the community. That included investing in BIPOC-led organizations. We know that arts organizations all over were really hurt, but it was especially acute in BIPOC organizations. So in order to help keep them afloat and then also to help them come back stronger once the pandemic was different. We also invested in supporting students in digital learning. And we, another big one that was just recently announced was another $5 million around community assets and transitions. So this was an idea of where properties in BIPOC communities, when they became open, that this trust fund would be able to buy those properties and hold them within the community rather than have them be snatched up by investment buyers that oftentimes change that property into something that is no longer in alignment or supports the community that exists there. And so I think that as we come out of the pandemic, we are continuing to support those grants, because that is all about building back better and greater within our region. And we have also, in terms of the pandemic of racism, we announced about 2 months ago an initiative. We're working with Edgar Villanueva of the Decolonizing Wealth Project. On a community trust fund. This is where we took out social impact bonds to raise $100 million, where we're putting a $50 million community trust fund in the Black community and a $50 million trust fund for the Native American community, where there will be steward organizations that grant money to individuals to address racial wealth disparities. So to invest in things like education, home ownership, small business development, which is different. And I hope that we'll be able to talk about this a little later. It's different in that the Bush Foundation will not be running that program. We are selecting two steward organizations that will receive $50 million each to design and operate those grant programs, and that those grant dollars aren't going to organizations. Eventually, they're going to individuals in order to build generational wealth.
Wow, we could spend a whole hour on this, on just your introduction and riffing on that. I love some of the things that you, one of the things you mentioned at the beginning was responsive grant making. We often talk about it, that in our trainings too, of there's, and I think what you just shared is such a beautiful example, especially being in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minneapolis area, of when things happen in our community, how grant makers are able to respond. Some of them are able to do, able and do respond, and yours is a perfect example. So thank you for bringing that into the room. Appreciate that. Yeah, go ahead, Tori.
Well, I community foundations by our very nature, we have priority areas and we certainly can focus, but I think we also end up doing a little bit of everything because generally the community dictates what we do. And so at what the community needs as they evolve and change, so does our grant making to follow suit. A couple of things that were really important to most community foundations around the country, many, many of them, if not all, were involved in what I would refer to as crisis response or COVID relief funds. And so more than likely, wherever you live, there was a community foundation may have partnered with other funders to provide dollars to nonprofits, to arts organizations, to essential human needs during the sort of the height of the pandemic. We were very similar in doing that. And so as we've moved out of that, that space, we actually were more focused on operational and unrestricted grant making than ever before. And so I would say one of our sort of permanent changes from that is we had a learning. We were all on a learning journey in our grant making. And I think we had some really significant learning about how we could have the most impact. And so we will forever make more unrestricted grants than we made before. We're also focused a lot on digital equity. I think we're not alone in that space. We had to wrap around our largest school district and many of our not-for-profits that were assisting families with out-of-school time. And so I think we'll continue to be a partner with municipalities and with our community as we address the digital divide. You know, we live in a place where we still lack broadband access. So not just affordable internet, but any high-speed internet. And so infrastructure is an important issue for us. And certainly we can't do that in philanthropy. We really need government to be the leader and the largest funder of that. One area that was new for us was understanding, we've often understood childcare access, but in a community that relies quite a bit on in-home childcare, both what I would call friend, family, and neighbor care or informal childcare, but also licensed, registered, home-based childcare providers. We came to know that space much more differently in the last year. And moving forward, we'll continue, I think, to have relationships with our childcare resource and referral network and to understand beyond childcare centers that are not-for-profits, maybe run by a well-known national brand nonprofit, but beyond that, how can we support the credentialing necessary to ensure that there's access to high quality, affordable childcare for all families? And certainly also wanting to support women returning to work since so many women had to leave the workforce because of childcare. I think there'll probably be some interest in knowing that we still care about arts and cultural organizations. We are not uniquely focused on essential human needs. That has been a question to us over the last 12 months. There are so many things that, you know, there are not enough dollars always to meet every need, but we're very much focused on making sure that the arts and culturals in our community, we're a small community, so we don't have tons of organizations that need support, but those that need our support need it now more than ever. And I think funders are able to balance the needs of right now with the needs of the community we want to see emerging from this. And in our community, we have something called the National Comedy Center, which I would invite all of you to Google and come and visit Jamestown, New York, where that is located. But it's an organization that really launched just about 18 months before the pandemic. And it's been really challenging to figure out how to continue through that space and certainly needs philanthropy to support it. And then I think the last piece is really understanding the future of nonprofit and community capacity building. And those will be priorities for us. They were priorities these before and they've changed a little bit. And we've seen some of the areas where we could really help to support our community in new and different ways.
Thank you so much, Sharon.
I think folks have covered a lot of great information for us at the Bonnet Foundation in terms of like COVID response and strategies that continue to stick. We too set aside funds for COVID response and also addressing institutional racism. And I think that's what the theme that we're seeing now going forward is, the DE&I stuff and addressing institutional racism. All foundations are talking about this. I mean, there's nonstop webinars and so I think that lens with the funding that we do is now part of everything that we do. So that's the only kind of strategy that's really changed. But then also just kind of a tactical thing, what I've noticed is the foundation requirements just in reporting and whatnot has been relaxed. And I've seen that with everything, right? So, foundations, I've always said like foundations made up all these rules, right? Where you need to do this report, you need this and this. And now I'm just like, we made up all these things. Why do it if it's not that important and it's taking away time from the grantees? So I think that will continue to stick, but that's a little more tactical. So
I thank you for bringing that up because there was actually some questions around the tactical stuff because the people that are watching, they also want to know that. So the reporting I've noticed has changed. A lot of the grant makers in previous webinars, they've streamlined their application process. They've streamlined their reporting process. I see Tori and Jackie were shaking her head. So maybe that's applicable for you all as well. And I want to pivot towards the tactical and pivot towards some of the really more specific questions that are kind of coming up and that came up before. I'm noticing in the chat, I'll start with this, the smaller nonprofits. So I'm noticing that smaller nonprofits, we all oftentimes get this question in trainings too. And I'll call them smaller nonprofits whose operating budgets are let's say less than $100,000, however long they've been around. They're often thinking of grant funding. Can we get funding? Are we eligible? If so, what strategies or tips might you have for us? What do we need to know? What are you looking at? Anything like that, any advice that you all could offer for those that are small and emerging and just getting started? Tori, would you start us off there?
I would. I would say that, we make over 400 grants a year, and the majority of those grants are going to those smaller nonprofits. Some of them are written by volunteers, so there may not even be any paid staff at all, or there are paid staff, but the grant writing is done on a volunteer basis by a board member or a community volunteer. So a community foundation, private foundations, I'm sure, are also great places, but I can speak from our perspective. We're really designed for that kind of accessibility. We will often have folks knock on the, come to the door back when you could do that, but hopefully they'll do it again and sit down to have a conversation with us to tell us about their idea, about their new organization, or about an organization that's been in the community a long time, but maybe reinventing itself or taking on a new project. And so I think of it's always great to make a personal connection. And I think Paul was mentioning, this idea of wanting to save folks time. So having that conversation rather than, just firing off a grant application, in some cases it can save you time because we might be able to tell you, I love your project. I love your idea. It's not a fit for us. Or we can say, we love your project. We love your idea. And here are some pointers. And so I think that can really help a smaller organization, if you have the capacity to have a face-to-face or a phone call. And sometimes you start with an email because that's an easy, non-threatening way to open the door. But however you open that door, I think that can happen. And I would say authenticity. I was thinking about what is it that makes grant applications resonate and what makes them succeed. And some of the smallest nonprofits write the most authentic grant applications. You can connect immediately with the passion and the vision. And so I think don't sell yourself short. If you're a small organization, you're a startup, you've never written a grant before, write from your heart. Read the instructions and make sure that you follow all the jump through all the boxes and the hoops, like our colleagues have said, but just right from the heart. And I think you'll be really surprised at the way that resonates with funders.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're sharing there, Tori. And I want to ask like a slight follow-up or to embellish a little, which is about, because the question comes up around how do we contact funders? And you just said, well, have a conversation with us. And I'd love to know for your foundation in particular, because I know it could be different for everybody. If an organization was planning to apply, what do you mean by initiate a conversation? How do potential grantees build a relationship with your foundation? This is a question, or how do they best communicate with you? What tips do you have there?
Well, I think you said a really important thing, Angela, which is every foundation is different. So when I say have a conversation, there may be a funder that says, please don't call. We don't do business that way. So it's important to understand the culture and the nature of the funder. You can't treat us all the same. I think you already said that once. So for our organization, our job is to respond to the inquiries of people who are interested and in need. And so we take the meetings, we take the phone calls, we return the emails. We try our best to be really timely with that. The last year has been a challenge for all of us in keeping up with the workload sometimes. So maybe what used to be a 24-hour turnaround time on an email response might be a couple days, but we'll still do it. So I would say whatever method of communication someone is comfortable with. I also think we have had our eyes opened in philanthropy in the last year. To realize we're not accessible. We might have thought we were, and certainly there are many foundations that have always been accessible, but some of us have looked at our process and said, how is it that you come to know me or come to connect with me? And how can we make that an open door instead of the black box? So I would say that even if you've had challenges in the past, try again, because folks are on a journey and they may have had some learning occur in the last year that allows them to say, you know what? That's not the right way for us to interact with the folks who need our help the most.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah, so, I mean, you said a couple great things, many great things. I think the first thing though is really understanding before you contact a foundation, making sure that you fall within their priority giving areas. So for example, if we do LGBT work and gun violence prevention, you know, I would not really consider a cancer research project, right? So it's just completely, there's no alignment whatsoever. So before you do, just to save your time and their time, just make sure there is some alignment within the programming areas. And then, and you know, Tori, you said this as well, which is, you know, really based on the foundation. If it's a small private family foundation where there's no staff, then it's going to be much harder to get a conversation with them or start a conversation with them. But if the foundation is staffed and there's program officers, the program officer is there, is hired to basically act as a conduit between the grantee and the foundation. And so really, and so I, you know, feel free to reach out to them and shoot them an email, but make sure again that there's alignment, right, to start the conversation. And then if you start the conversation and it gets into the ask components, you know, just kind of know that most foundations, not all, but most foundations don't want to be the sole funder, right? So if you have a $100,000 budget and you ask for $100,000, that's typically not going to happen. What I've noticed is most foundations, you know, will grant up to 20 to 30% of an operating budget. And oftentimes it's much lower. It's like 10%. So just kind of keep that in mind in terms of an ask. But I mean, Jackie, Tori, what are your thoughts on that piece?
Yeah, in terms of the ask at the Bush Foundation, if it is a good idea and we believe in it, we are fine and we will be proud to be the sole sponsor. And we will do whatever we can in order to also support your additional fundraising. If we really believe in that effort and we think that it's going to make our region better, then we feel that we have the ability to put our necks on the line in order to support this work, and hope, and also having the understanding that once you have that funder, that first funder, that the additional funders can be easier oftentimes to get. I think that in terms of how to reach out, Tori and Paul just gave really good advice. I think spending some time on the website, and so often Well, I don't know if it's often, but for our foundation, it is very clear that we offer inquiry appointments. Usually you can get them within a couple of weeks where you can spend 20 minutes or 30 minutes with a program officer to talk about your idea, for them to help you consider other angles to it. And that is so much more appreciated, to spend the time and make that appointment rather than the rambling voicemails and at the end say, and give me a call. And so I'll give you a call because we like to be responsive, but also we have other mechanisms that make it easier for us to be responsive by making that appointment.
Angela, may I just throw in one other item, which is, I think knowing the culture of a funder, which seems hard. How can I know the culture if I've never met them? But talk to your other nonprofit colleagues and peers, because that's a good way to get insight. And one thing I know is that there are funders who like to be the initial gift. They want to be the first money in. There are also funders who want to know that it's a sure bet that all the other dollars have been raised and they are last money in. And then there's a whole bunch all across the spectrum. So I think it's just important to know sometimes the way to go is exactly what Jackie said, right? We could be all in on the project. We could be the first and the only gift. And in other cases, there may be projects where a funder wants a little more assurance that the project will go forward, or they want to be a smaller share.
That's great. Thank you. You know, there's a couple of overlapping themes here I just want to lift up, because I think this is just such a question that comes up to people, which is, how do we communicate? And one of the things that I hear is alignment, whether that be in terms of program area, whether that be in terms of some of the questions even that are coming up, or do they fund outside of the area? And I think that this kind of falls under it too, where sometimes potential grantees are, they'll see a funding source and they'll say, can we convince them to fund in a different way? When, you know, what I hear Jackie and the rest of you all saying is like, this is what our foundation does. Do the research on what we do, and we're happy to talk to you about it and see if it's a good fit. And the key word in that is a good fit, which means each of your foundations has something that you're doing. So I'm imagining, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, so Jackie, you guys have your geographic area. I'm imagining that doesn't mean you fund, let's say, Texas. Or Tori, I'm imagining you don't fund in New York City. And then to Paul, in your case where you don't accept unsolicited proposals, what if I'm a program that I think, but I really think we would be very much aligned. You just don't know us yet. Could I send you an LOI? Do you encourage it, discourage it? What do you tell? Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So let's see. So our contact information, my email address and whatnot, is all listed on our website. So folks can feel free to send in information. So I'll respond to it. That's my job, right? So that's why I'm hired, to respond to things. We don't ignore things, but there has to be, again, alignment. So I would say, feel free to reach out. And then also kind of two things, and I think this can go on with, when you get funding, when you build a relationship, blah, blah, blah. But, we as grant makers, we're oftentimes just ask for money. But sometimes it's actually nice. Say you got mentioned, I actually just got an email 3 days ago. One of our grantees, they were mentioned in the New York Times, and they just sent me an email. Oh, we were just in the New York Times. You know, great. Just want to share the information. Da da da. And those emails we remember because there's not an ask tied to it, right? And so that builds this kind of relationship. And these are long-term strategies, right? Relationships are not transactional, right? So this work is not transactional. This is a partnership between the grantee and us, and that's how we see our work. And then also something to consider is, while we may not, if you do send just an LOI or some little brief on your organization, it may not be a fit for me right now. It may be a fit for us a year from now. You just never know. And then also, just like the nonprofit agencies, you all talk to each other and share information, foundations do the same exact thing. For example, just last week, I had a colleague of mine call me up and say, what are these small LGBT organizations that you love that you haven't funded because I have this corporation that wants to give $200,000. And so I gave them the list. And so the, again, all this information sharing happens on the back end. So it's just not transactional, and it's just relationship building takes a lot of cultivation and effort. And we understand that though. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's brilliant. And it really speaks. One of the things we say in the in our training is like every conversation and every email is, you know, it's relationship building, all of it. And we think of it in the long view. It's not like, all right, I'm going to, you know, email Jackie. If she didn't respond the way I want, this is over. I'll never apply there again. It just might take some time. And there was a question that came in, which I think this is a kind of a goes along with this is there such a thing as over stewardship? Have you ever had an experience where, you know, if we've all had relationships where someone's like maybe over communicating. So have any of you ever had an experience where something that you would consider as over stewardship? The specific question wanted to know about, in addition to reports, do you want to receive e-news, hard copy newsletters, additional updates? Like what's the sweet spot in the stewardship when it comes to your grantees? Any other additions you could add there?
I think that here you just treat them like people, and would you want to send like to so many all that information to your auntie? You know, would she appreciate that? Maybe she would, but maybe she wouldn't. So I think just you know we're people too, and I think sharing. There's nothing wrong with that. If you always expect a response, that might be difficult. You have to think about the portfolios that we of grantees that we all manage. It would be difficult to respond to every new newsletter. But I am for just about all my grantees, I'm getting their monthly newsletter, and I like to read them and know what's going on. And it's not that frequent that I then reply to each of them and say, very cool of what you're doing here. You know, that there's just not enough time to do that, but I think it's okay.
Awesome. Have anything to add?
I was just going to say one of the best strategies that happened for our foundation during the pandemic, we had a couple nonprofits that just on their own chose to do a philanthropic update, an email. And it was, so it wasn't going out to every constituent they had. It was tailored and it was, you know, the voice of the executive director to the funder and giving just relevant information, kind of a heads up as to where things were, both good and bad. So I think Paul had talked about, we love to be in communication sometimes before the ask, or it helps us to know the ask might be coming if this is a long-term relationship we have with an organization. But so it's a combination of, we don't want you to do more work. It's not go create a funder newsletter and send it out quarterly. You know, don't make another to-do, but just again, with that authenticity as your North Star, an email letting us know what's going on. I had an organization reach out to let us know that they were considering a move and it was going to change their operating expenses, not wanting advice, not wanting permission, but just wanting to give us that heads up and letting us know that they were able to cover it inside their own existing fundraising. So that was great news too. So just, I think you can't over communicate, but try to do it in a way that is somewhat targeted if you can, without creating too much work.
Thank you. All right. So I want to sort of pivot a little bit and talk about the actual proposals. I know all of you review a lot of proposals, talk to a lot of grantees. And one of the questions, this is kind of a combination of the several questions, which is, what are the top three things that make an application stay at the top list of grant applications, and the top three mistakes potential grantees make in their applications? So people are looking for what are things that really stand out as strong applications, and then what are some suggestions for don't do that would be the way. And Paul, would you start us off this time?
Sure. I'm not sure if there's three things, but I think the most important thing is when I look for, or when folks do it really well, is just taking a needs-based approach in the proposal. So not really, describing what the need is and what the community need is, and that's how those are the best proposals, hands down. Because why reinvent the wheel or start something new just because you think it's a great idea? No, you need there needs to be a community need in order for it to be funded. And then some tactical things, things not to do. I think, typos are just, it's presentation skills, right? So being formal and not having a lot of typos or not having any typos, oftentimes we get a standard, you can, it's like an LOI, but they put the wrong foundation name in because you can tell that they just did this mass email blast, which does, this happens to me all the time. So little things like that, which, signal, the reason why that is important is because when we do start a relationship with a grantee, we look at it as a partnership, right? So two things, as a foundation, there's financial capital that we provide. So that's the check that we write. And then the other thing, how I really look at my work or our foundation's work, is the social capital that we bring to the table. So social capital means, can I introduce you to other foundation funders? Can I help in other ways and provide access to networks? Because as a foundation, we have access to a lot of relationships. So how can I bridge the gap on that end as well? But these typos, and the reason why I bring that up, presentation skills is important, is because, if we are going to back you, we feel like, we're putting our name behind the work. And so those are my little things. How about anyone else?
Thank you.
Let's see. I would say I agree, Paul, with that community engagement, that community informed proposal. So we don't want folks to swoop in and say, here's the solution, community. We want to hear that the community is bringing it, that the community is part of it, that the community was a part of shaping what that proposal is. So we would like to see that. I think I have a different angle, actually, with the super formal. We actually have moved to very simple application for that community innovation grant program. That's our open door that's always open. It is just four questions and with actually pretty short fields, because we don't want that to be a barrier for people reaching out, for organizations reaching out to us. And so for there, we really wanted to just be authentic, and we want you to be able to explain why we should consider your organization, and that you should sound like yourselves. And also, that's for the Bush Foundation. So it might be very different in other organizations. But then Paul mentioned this earlier too, but the criteria and the eligibility. Understand how we're choosing what we're looking for. And we're a regional foundation. Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that geography. If you come with something from Pennsylvania that no one in our region has asked for or is partnering on, then that's going to be a decline and probably a waste of your time. And then one more thing, understand other grants that the foundation has made. Oftentimes foundations have on their websites grantees, recent grantees, maybe a whole, we have a history, decades of grantees available on our database there. So understand what kind of things have been funded recently and be receptive to maybe we aren't a fit and maybe we shouldn't apply.
I'm so glad that you brought up that part about the researching on your current grantees. I think that's an underestimated part of the research that I like to emphasize in our trainings too, because it's like many of the grant makers, they take extensive care to list who do we fund and what have we done. And if they don't list it, you can find it very easily on the 990, which really gives a sense of your ask amounts, trends of giving. And I think that really helps with grantees kind of in terms of building relationship. All of you are lifting this up, which is like, this is really building a relationship with our grant makers or a partnership with them. And so doing our due diligence as grantees, potential grantees, to really look at what are your areas of, what are your areas of interest and your trends. So thank you for bringing that up, Jackie. Tori, how about you?
So this is very tactical, but if we ask for budgets or financials, provide accurate information, because when the financials are inaccurate, it doesn't matter how wonderful your idea is, but if it calls into question what's going on in your organization, that could get, you know, that could disqualify you unnecessarily. And it's just for maybe a typo. It could be, I sent the wrong, I attached or uploaded the wrong document into the portal. So just make sure your financials tie out. In the case of community foundations, you're not only being reviewed by staff, but in many cases, there are community volunteers and community voice at the table. And there's always CPAs at those tables. So make sure that those folks are not going to get so deep into your financial reports and see something that's not quite, you know, doesn't add up and derail you. So that's just very tactical. When we write grants, we have to bring our finance people, whether they're paid or volunteers, we got to bring them to the table.
Angela, may I add one more that I want, that I meant to?
For sure.
Jargon and acronyms. So when we're looking at all across so many different types of issues and so many applications, and then I get to one and it has the ZWXP, and because we're doing this because of the X2, and then I have to spend so much time trying to figure out what you're even talking about because there's so many acronyms. That can be frustrating. I will spend the time to figure out the acronyms, but it doesn't put your application, I think, it doesn't make it easy. Thank you.
What's your preferred way, Jackie?
Explain what you're talking about so you have to, I often think I have I have little kids, but I think about my first grader. So maybe not explain it to a first grader, but can I explain this to a fifth grader? Or can I explain it to my dad who isn't familiar with this particular issue? I think that you should, I would suggest that organizations would consider that, unless you know otherwise, that the reader is not as familiar with the issue or what you're speaking of as you are. And so help bring them along.
Great.
And I would like to add one thing. Also the type of funding. So I know, speaking for our foundation, we're not in the business of putting out fires. So like folks approaching us because they can't pay rent next month, or they can't make payroll. Foundation funders tend to fund projects such as capacity building. And that's like, you know, doing a strat plan or D&I efforts with the board or whatever. So projects like that, but not something that's like not, I call them like putting out fire. So like, you know, because what would happen is, say you approach a foundation for next month's rent. Well, okay, yeah, the foundation pays next month's rent, but then you're in the same situation a month from now. So foundation funders are just more interested in funding projects that have like a growth kind of capacity building potential, aside from general operating support.
Mm. Perfect. And that, which is like the perfect segue, because there, I see a question about program capacity building, project support, general operating. We probably don't have time to define all of what those are, but I do want to just touch on this general operating, because I think that when it comes to writing a general operating grant, what are some of the things that that you're looking for organizations to demonstrate in their narratives? So those of you that don't know, a general operating grant, rather than being a program for program support, which is we want you to fund, we would request to fund our tutoring program. And that money is then designated or restricted towards that program. General operating is more general, and a lot of organizations use it for administrative costs, but they can do it unrestricted, so you can use it how you want. So when it comes to creating those kind of applications, they're a little bit different, right? Because they're not describing a specific program. So do you, any of you have any suggestions on how to make those applications strong, general operating in particular?
I think the ones that have been the most successful in the last year, and this sounds counter to what we've been dealing with, but talking about the sustainability of the organization as a whole. So while there is an unrestricted there's an operational need or a gap in the operational budget, and in order to move forward, these dollars are necessary, I think it's important to convey, again, with authenticity, how sustainable is the organization in the future if this is viewed as a one-time ask. What steps is the organization taking, or what things are going to change that will change that need in the future? Or quite honestly, if this is an annual need and it will always be a gap because a particular community just cannot cannot sustain an organization at the level necessary to deliver, that can be okay too, but you have to say that. I think what happens to organizations when they come to a funder and they say, we only need help this one time, or we need help to launch this program, but then it will be sustainable through this mechanism. If that doesn't pan out, we have a long memory sometimes and it can do a disservice. And so we don't want to say, well, you told us. So I would just be, just be very authentic about it, but don't overstate or do, just only the best case scenario. Sometimes scenario planning is helpful with an operational grant. So that's just some tidbits. Mm.
Great. Perfect. Anyone else to add? Okay. Go ahead, Jackie.
Oh, I was going to say, that's another one where you understand the criteria for the particular grant program. So we have a grant program that we call the ecosystem, where we fund, it runs every 3 years, but we're funding organizations that do work that make it so that other organizations within the region can do their work better. It might be by doing research, it might be through their policy work, but it, because of the work that they do, other organizations are better supported in what they do. And so that's something that we do just every 3 years. And so making sure that, which grant are you applying to? Are you applying to something which is more project and initiative based, which is what we typically do, or is this the opportunity for a general operating grant?
Yeah, and Jackie, you touched on this, but it's, I think at the end of the day, when it comes to general operating support, it's really about ensuring that there's alignment, right? And so that tends to be a key word, ensuring that the our priority areas match your work, and then we're more inclined to fund general operating support. So at the Bonnet Foundation, we fund, we've always done general operating, so it's nothing new to us. We do LGBT immigration equality work. And so we just look for organizations that come to us that do LGBT immigration work. And so we just provide a grant, make a general operating support grant that way. So I think it's really just about, not just, but a big piece of it is really ensuring that there is alignment with the work that y'all do.
Thank you. So we have time for maybe one or two more quick questions. This one I want to bring up because we don't usually often get this one, but it's actually a question for each of you. A lot of people are really impressed by your initiatives, the work that your foundations are doing, the community engagement, and they're curious about your professional path into the grant making side of things. So if somebody was out there was interested in being able to make impact in this way, maybe each of you could just share a little bit about some steps that you took. They're curious about this side of things. So maybe you could offer some advice on that from your personal journeys. Paul, would you start us off?
Sure. So let's see. I started at the foundation. Foundation's been around for 21 years. I've been there for 20 years. And so I was 12 at the time. Just kidding.
Right.
I'm just kidding.
Prodigy.
I started out as an administrative assistant and I worked myself up to the number two. And as you'll see with a lot of foundations, there's not a lot of movement. Let me talk about private family foundations. Within private family foundations, there tends to not be a lot of movement in terms of staff. So it's really about getting your foot in the door and then staying there. And then folks usually stay at the foundation for quite some time. Why is that? It's because you're dealing with somebody, a family's, for a private family foundation, if they are still living, you are dealing with somebody's family's money. And so it's all about trust. It's all about being a trusted advisor to the family. And so, so what I've seen with all my associates that work at private family foundations. It's like, is you have to get your foot in the door and then they tend to stay there and then move on up. Even at some larger foundations like Hilton here in LA, CCF, I mean, you know, folks tend to stay there because you're dealing with somebody's money.
Thank you so much.
See, so I've only been in philanthropy for 3 years. I started in 2018. So I still feel, it's been almost 3 years. So now I feel like I'm here, but I spent most of my career actually in public school district administration doing various senior leadership roles and operations and budget and strategy and lobbyists and things like that. And so my path into the foundation was, through the work that I did in education and making connections and meeting people. And then when this opportunity became open, I took advantage of it. It's very different from public school district, you know, urban public school district administration. It took a little while to get used to being in the position to really help organizations and great ideas come to life rather than trying to stretch every penny and still often having to, cut people at every budget cycle back in public school districts. So I think that for me, it was becoming a leader in a field and then seeing this opportunity.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
My path is the least likely, so I'm glad I went last. I worked in the public health and not-for-profit background and was a volunteer, served on a private foundation board at a younger age and got to see the work that was happening in philanthropy. Kind of otherwise, I'm not sure how you know to discover this. It wasn't on my things I wanted to do when I grew up bucket list, but I then had an opportunity to lead the local United Way and community foundations, different than private and family foundations, are still in the fundraising and donor engagement space. So our donors are walking through the door every day. And so I think if you enjoy fundraising, if you enjoy donor stewardship and donor engagement, that's a great pathway to the work. And you can work in the community foundation side. We often have the battle between the folks who are working on the grant making side and the folks working on the donor engagement side. Not that they're not always in perfect alignment, but you know, those are two different sides of philanthropy in the community foundation space.
Thank you. So we're at the top of the hour. I want to thank you all so much for your answers. Several of the questions people are saying they appreciate you. They're appreciating the work that you're doing and they're appreciating the time that you shared. And I think if I was to lift up three words from our conversation today, they would be partnership / relationship, authenticity, and responsiveness. Each of you really shared in different ways. And I think it really gives grantees or potential grantees that feeling that sometimes there can be that distance between the grant maker and themselves. And what you all have done is really bridge that here today. And I'm just really appreciative of your time and generosity and the way you even picked up on each other's comments. So thank you so much for being here. I want to actually just give each of you 10 seconds or something to do any one closing thing you want to share. I know we're just a little tiny bit out of time, but I think it's important for everyone for you all to be the last word. So Tori, would you start us with just a final thing you'd like to share?
Well, I imagine most of the folks on this are grant seekers and they are working in the nonprofit and community space. And I would just say, take a moment and really breathe deep and say to yourself, I made it through the last 15 months, and just be encouraged and know that funders see you. We know we don't know how hard it is. We imagine sometimes how hard some of your work has been and how much work there is left to do to think about how we move our communities and our nation forward. So just know that you are seen and appreciated.
Jackie?
Yeah, I think Angela, you hit it. You said it really well, which is, I think at the end of the day, this work is really about a partnership, right? So we really look at this work as partnering together and advancing the work that we are all doing together. So you all asked some really great questions. And so I just want to say thank you. This is a lot of fun and feel free to reach out anytime.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. Ditto to both Tori and Paul. And I would just like to express gratitude for the work that all of you do in your nonprofits. You are making a difference for the people that you serve. And it is an honor as a foundation to be able to support that work. And when we're not, we still really believe in the work. And even if we aren't able to fund it. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you for doing this hard work. And thank you, Angela and the Grantmanship Center for this experience. This was fun.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to our sponsors, the Grantsmanship Center, GrantStation, Foundant. We do these webinars quarterly. The next one will be August 18th, which you'll all be getting a message about. Each of our sponsors has great resources in terms of training, databases, software to support your nonprofit. So I hope you'll check out all of our websites. Have a really wonderful rest of your day, and we hope to see you next time. Thank you.